From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina ranks number 19 in a recent state-by-state assessment of freedom. Why? And what can the state do to rank even higher? We'll ask the authors who compiled the rankings. North Carolina's criminal code is so confusing, it needs a complete rewrite. That's the assessment of a professor from the UNC School of Government. You'll hear her argument. You'll learn how an up-to-date criminal code could benefit normal, law-abiding people. Speaking of rewrites, advocates for public charter schools have argued for a change in the charter approval process. They want to ensure the timeline for approvals doesn't trip up worthwhile charter school plans. And some North Carolina Republicans have joined the chorus supporting Medicaid expansion in the state. You'll hear an assessment of their proposal. It's called Carolina Cares. The John Locke Foundation's top healthcare expert offers her critique. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It is playing out as a tug of war between lawmakers who say they're trying to protect North Carolina farmers and other lawmakers who say they're trying to protect the rights of property owners. At the center of this debate, hog farming in North Carolina, and those who say that they're impacted by it in a negative way. Rick Henderson is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been reporting on this fascinating story of legislation making its way through the General Assembly. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, let's kind of lay out for our listeners what the debate is here. Those folks who are say they're supporting farmers, what is it that they want?
What they want is they want a provision in state law that would limit the amount of damages that can be paid under certain nuisance lawsuits, mainly, in this case, narrowly targeting hog farmers and what happens when they spray the waste lagoons or when, for instance, during the hottest part of summer, if flies or other critters get
it smells bad.
You have flies and other insects that go across off their property lines and can affect their neighbors. And what they want to do is they want to say you can sue for a nuisance, but you can only recover actual damages equal to the value of the property for the nuisance. And instead of suing for other sorts of damages, such as, let's say, if there are health issues involved with this, if someone if their asthma condition is worsened symptomatically because of the smell, the odor, the pollution, whatever, or if the water quality is damaged, then you're limited in damages. In this case, you can't get, if you will, punitive damages, just compensatory damages.
For those of us who maybe watch Judge Judy, it sounds sort of like you're describing almost the pain and suffering type
aspect
of recovering damages. Okay, so that's what they're wanting. Now tell us what those who say that they are supporting property rights want out of this.
What they would like to do is to have there are several arguments they're making. The immediate argument with this bill is that there should be a respect of the common law principle that a nuisance can involve more than just damaging your property. It can involve making your home unlivable. It can damage your quality of life in a very perceptible and measurable way. And so they want the current set of limits to stay in place, which allows collection of punitive damages. And they also think that they also argue that if you're wanting to enact something like a tort reform provision, which is what this is, you shouldn't just single out one industry. You should have this comprehensive. You shouldn't pick winners and losers as this particular bill would do. And so before we even get into the other aspect that we will, which is the litigation that inspired this, what they're saying is if you're going to set limits to tort claimants' damages, let's not say only for this industry and not for every other industry.
Now, hog farming in North Carolina, no matter how long you've lived here, you probably already realize that this is huge.
Yes, it's a big industry. In fact, we're one of the largest pork producers in the world. And the company that's involved at the center of this dispute is Smithfield Foods, which is the largest pork producer in the world.
There's litigation that involves the Smithfield firm. Now, tell us why this legal case has even become part of the conversation as it relates to this debate in the General Assembly.
First lawsuit was filed against Smithfield and some other smaller farmers, some of whom contract with Smithfield, in 2014. I believe it involved 7 lawsuits initially. Now it's up to 26 separate lawsuits and more than 540 plaintiffs involved. And cases have all been consolidated in federal court, even though they're suing under a state nuisance law. They've been consolidated in federal court. And the interest in getting this particular bill passed as originally written was to have it apply to a case that's now in court. So it would interfere with existing litigation. And the reason for this is stated by the supporters of the hog farmers is that the case is sort of stuck right now because the judge, Earl Britt, the federal judge involved in the case, has said that North Carolina statute is unclear about how damages should be provided in what the defendant, Smithfield, is arguing is a temporary nuisance. In other words, they're saying this is not something that bothers you all the time. This is just something that happens under certain weather conditions, during certain seasonal cycles of the hog production process, and that this should not be considered a permanent nuisance. If it were a permanent nuisance, the law is very clear about that. But the law is sort of silent on how to handle temporary nuisances, and so that's why the hog farmers want to reach into this lawsuit and place some limit on the damages.
Really interesting in your reporting on this, because you were there and you were listening to some of the debate among the legislators, and there was some comments that I thought were particularly fascinating from State Representative Joe John, who talked about whether or not the legislature should really try to do something involving litigation, current litigation.
Right. Joe John is a former member of the North Carolina Court of Appeals, who recently won a legislative seat in Wake County. And Representative John said, this is potentially a separation of powers dispute, because what we're actually having is the legislature stepping in and trying to weigh in on one side of another of a judicial matter that's actually ongoing right now. And we got similar sorts of comments from that from Republicans, Representative John Blust of Guilford County, Representative Hugh Blackwell from Burke County, who both were saying that we don't want to get involved in a situation like this because there is this concern that we are trying to pick winners in an ongoing lawsuit. What they also said, by the way, is other Democrats joined this argument in saying that when Judge Britt said in his order that North Carolina statute is not clear about what role the damages should play here, he was simply stating facts. He was saying the law doesn't have clarity. Now, the hog farmers and their supporters in the General Assembly said, Judge Britt was saying, you need to give us guidance here. You know, I need to know which way to go here. And they were saying, no, he was just simply saying it's not clear.
So, Rick, the hog farming industry, obviously very powerful, influential forces. Hog farming is huge part of the North Carolina economy. Yet we also have a General Assembly where you have a lot of legislators who are really committed to preserving and protecting property rights of every North Carolinian. So it's a really interesting tug of war, I think, that is going on. Is there any way for folks to meet in the middle on this?
Well, what happened to make this to resolve this issue for now anyway was that Representative Blust, whom I mentioned earlier, proposed an amendment which would simply say this law cannot affect ongoing litigation. And he said, essentially said, if you want to narrowly pass a tort reform bill affecting only hog farmers, okay, I'm not crazy about it, but if we do that, then let's make sure that we're not getting involved. Let's make sure that we're not deciding a case on one side or another right now. And that's what they did. It was a very narrow vote, 59-56, but the underlying legislation then passed. And it's not exactly clear if Governor Cooper will sign it if it ever gets to his desk.
Well, it is a fascinating story for sure. And Carolina Journal has been covering this quite extensively. Rick Henderson has been reporting on it. He's been our guest here. He, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal and CarolinaJournal.com. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Fans of the John Locke Foundation know that this think tank is promoting the goal first in freedom, that is, making North Carolina the freest state in the nation. There's some good news on that front, courtesy of the Libertarian Cato Institute. Joining us now with details are the authors of a new report from Cato that offers that good news. William Ruger is Vice President of Policy and Research at the Charles Koch Institute. Jason Sorens is a lecturer and Program Director of the Political Economy Project at Dartmouth College. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So good news on the front of freedom for North Carolina, and that is thanks to this report that Cato puts out on freedom in the 50 states. Tell us what it says about North Carolina.
Well, North Carolina is not one of the very top states on freedom, but we do show increase since 2010. So we look at freedom in three different areas: fiscal policy, which has to do with taxes and government spending; regulation, which has to do with restrictions on business especially; and personal freedom, which has to do with lifestyle freedoms as well as things like educational choice. And we find that North Carolina has improved specifically on fiscal policy. Taxes have fallen over the past few years, and in educational freedom.
When you looked at the various states and how they're going up and down on these rankings, did North Carolina's improvement stand out to you too?
I think it does. North Carolina is a state that had declined some from 2000 to 2010. So it had fallen a little behind a number of other states, especially in the region. And so North Carolina sticks out as a state that has improved on several policies across the board since then. However, we do note there are some areas where North Carolina does stick out for still being much less free than the average state.
Yeah, so one of those, one biggie, is occupational licensing, which really is we're not really talking about whether medical doctors are licensed.
Right.
We're talking about the whole range of things in which people have to get government approval to actually earn a living and make their lives better for them and their families. And North Carolina has way too many of those and really could improve by eliminating many of these. And a lot of times these occupational licenses really are ways in which people in those professions can keep out new entrants, which essentially is a way of what economists call rent seeking. It's a way of boosting their profits at the expense of others who aren't able to get into that profession and compete.
That is the voice of William Ruger. You also heard from Jason Sorens. You looked, obviously, in putting together this report at all of the 50 states. Are there some general trends that you saw, either good or bad?
Well, we did definitely see that the federal government has generally played an adverse role in freedom at the state level. Federal courts have played a good role in increasing personal freedom. But when we look at, for instance, health insurance regulation, that used to be an area where states could try different things. Now we have a one-size-fits-all federal law, And that has significantly reduced freedom among all 50 states because now they're forced to conform to this one highly regulated model.
Yeah. Any other outstanding trends that that you think the state should pay attention to?
Well, one thing I think you could pay attention to is the fact that you're roughly in the same general neighborhood of freedom with your neighboring states, states like Virginia and South Carolina. But compared to Tennessee, you perform a lot less well. So Tennessee is one of the freer states in the union. It's a top five state. And, you know, having that competitive edge in your neighborhood is something that all states should try to take advantage of. You know, so you don't necessarily have to be the freest state in the union, which would be great if you're trying to push towards that. But even if you could be in Indiana, say, in the Midwest, which is freer than states like Illinois, or you could be in New Hampshire, which is freer than the states like Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maine, or even be Arizona or Nevada in a territory where you're near California, which is one of the least free states in the country.
So as our folks here in North Carolina are looking for ways to improve on freedom, you mentioned occupational licensing. But another thing they might want to do is see what Tennessee is doing and see what works there that might work here.
Exactly. I mean, not to mention the fact that you could just look across the 50 states and use the data we have in our study to compare yourself. So something I used to tell people in Texas a lot when I lived there was, look, you'd be surprised, but Vermont, which is very liberal, a blue state, right, Bernie Sanders territory, has better gun laws when it comes to gun freedom than Texas does. And they'd say, no way. But you look at the data, it was very clear that Vermont was doing better than Texas. And that puts, you know, the onus on a state that cares about freedom or claims to care about freedom to say, maybe we need to do things a little bit better here.
You brought up something that's a very important point, and that is that states that are looking to become more free can look at this report and find easy substantive things they could do that would make themselves more free. It's not just this sort of floating in the ether idea of more freedom. You could actually find policies in other states, emulate them, and see your own state become freer.
Right. Like, so Justice Brandeis talked about how the states are kind of laboratories for democracy. In a lot of ways, he's talking about, you know, them experimenting with progressive reforms. But I think that people who care about freedom can also look to different states. And our data and just kind of our kind of federal system that we have in this country allows us to see what other people are doing to improve in a freedom-enhancing direction. And you can just look around because a lot of times people might say, well, that won't work. How could that work? Well, you could say, well, look, it's working in Oregon or it's working in New Hampshire or it's working in Tennessee, particularly when you're close to that area. So Tennessee or South Carolina or Virginia would be good examples for North Carolina to point to because these are relatively similar states in certain ways.
Yeah. I mean, the other point I would make is that there's no policy in this study that is crazy, extreme, you know, beyond the pale, because they're all policies that at least one state has been trying. So, you know, if you simply became as free as the freest state on all the dimensions that we look at, you'd be vastly ahead, of all the other states, and you wouldn't be some sort of libertarian utopia. You'd simply just be, you know, the most free market state on all these dimensions, and that would be enough to make you, you know, really stand out.
And it really matters. You know, so this isn't just us saying that, well, we like freedom and therefore you should adopt these policies. I hope you would love freedom enough that you'd want to adopt freer state regimes. But the fact is that it also affects other kind of consequences. So, for example, it affects economic growth. It affects whether citizens leave and pick up and go to other states or whether you're attracting other citizens and their those jobs and those businesses. And that matters a lot. I mean, a state like New York, for example, lost more than 10% of its 2,000 population over the last 15 years. And what that means is that if you're raising your kids in upstate New York, they're more likely to leave the state and move to a freer state. And there's nothing wrong with that for their own life project. But the fact is wouldn't we like to have opportunities for people in our own communities? And we can do that through attracting the kind of people and jobs that will allow us to flourish.
That surprised us a little bit, actually. When we first started this, we thought, well, maybe people move for jobs. And so maybe economic freedom would attract people simply because it creates a better economic environment. And that does seem to be true, but we also found that people seem to move for personal freedom. So people are moving from states with less personal freedom to states with more personal freedom. And no matter what we control for, this comes out in the statistics. So it's a really interesting finding.
Yeah, it's not just that people are moving to places that have better weather. I mean, certainly North Carolina benefits from that. But when you even control for that statistically, you're seeing that people are voting with their feet for more free states.
Well, North Carolina ranks number 19 in this latest report, the Cato Freedom in the 50 States report. That does mark improvement, but there's also room for even more improvement. We thank William Ruger and Jason Sorens, the authors of this report. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina legal reformers are focusing on a concept called mens rea, meaning that people need to have a guilty mind to be convicted of a crime. But during a recent forum on the topic, UNC professor Jessica Smith raised a larger issue.
The bigger problem is that in North Carolina, we lack a streamlined, comprehensive, orderly, and principled criminal code. And that causes a number of problems. One is it causes tremendous inefficiency in the system, which drives up costs for everybody in the system. It also leads for opportunities for unfairness. And in the end, I think it actually undermines the criminal law. So what do I mean when I say we lack a streamlined, comprehensive, orderly, and principled code? Well, we have Chapter 14 in the North Carolina General Statutes that is entitled our criminal code. It's criminal law. It has most of the codified offenses in North Carolina, But felony offenses can be found in 53 separate chapters of the general statutes. Misdemeanors can be found in 143 separate chapters of the general statutes. And that's not all. Under North Carolina law, we delegate the authority to create criminal law to administrative boards and bodies. So, for example, the Board of Dental Examiners is allowed to create crimes by regulation. And a dentist who advertises services without specifying whether he is a generalist or a specialist dentist is a criminal in North Carolina. In addition to delegating to administrative boards and bodies, North Carolina law also delegates authority to cities, counties, towns, and metropolitan sewerage districts the authority to create crimes by ordinance. So one tiny town in North Carolina, population just over 5,000, has a local ordinance that says it is unlawful to allow chickens to be at large in the town. A person who allows chickens to be at large in that town has committed a Class 3 misdemeanor under North Carolina law. In addition to this, our code, the part that is codified, is incomplete. We haven't dealt with a host of principles and concepts that are central to criminal law.
That's UNC Professor Jessica Smith. She's making the case for reform of North Carolina's overly complicated criminal code. Reform would require action from the General Assembly. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Do new North Carolina charter schools need more time to address regulators' concerns? Alex Quigley thinks so. The head of the state's Charter School Advisory Board recently explained why during a presentation to the state school board.
Part of this builds off of last summer when we had some recommendations that came back that were denied at the state board level. It was very late in the season. So you have schools that have been approved as early as February or approved or recommended at the Charter School Advisory Board level, sent to the state board, but then the denial came in August. We didn't get the final recommendations to you all until June, and then July was a called meeting. We didn't want to make those decisions then. So we want to avoid this because time is of the essence when you're opening a school. And the sooner a school can begin laying the groundwork, even if they haven't been formally approved by the state board, but they're beginning to put things in place. And then once they get that approval from the state board, we want to empower the schools that have that recommendation and have been approved to have as much time as possible. So that's one. So we are working really hard on our side to get the recommendations to you as soon as possible, so that all decisions by the state board can be made by June.
What would happen in June?
At your June meeting, you would give us a recommendation, or you would make your final decision based on our recommendation. And if in the case of a denial, we are asking that you would send that school back to us for us to have another opportunity to review again and send another recommendation forward. So in that situation, a school would at least know in June, hey, you're actually in a different situation than the schools that had been formally approved by the state board in June. So we're kind of trying to move this process more quickly. I sat through 3 days of applicant review meetings just a couple weeks ago. So we are working really hard to get everything to you in plenty of time for you to make informed decisions. And I think this will, most importantly, equip schools to have successful openings.
State School Board member Becky Taylor had a question.
Let me just make sure that we are going to give these schools the time that they're going to need, because if they come to us in, are they coming to us in May?
Yes.
Okay, so if they come to us in May and we disagree with a recommendation that the CSAB sent, then so they would go back to the CSAB. When would they come back to us?
They would probably be July or August, but at least then that school knows in June, hey, there's a strong possibility that you might not get moved, you might not get a charter at that point. And so I think it's you're basically moving up by 2 months or more that decision for them. And even though we would need to meet again, we also, if necessary, you know, it could be the type of thing we could do a called meeting to expedite returning the application to you. We're just trying to build in time to have that, mm-hmm. have them have another opportunity before the Charter School Advisory Board. What is the mindset around this? The mindset is the Charter School Advisory Board it does an extensive amount of deep research and time and energy. We now have a two-step interview process that we're implementing this year where we have folks before us for a 30-minute clarification interview, followed by then they're invited back for a full formal hour-long board interview. That's mm-hmm. after we've scored in the application whether or not we believe each section is a pass or a fail. The wish from the board is that if we disagree, and I understand that there will be times when that happens, that particularly around the application process, that we have a chance to step back, review again, and then send a decision forward to the Charter School Advisory Board or to the State Board from the CSAB. Mm-hmm. I do think that certainly I know that applicants would be okay with if they were they would rather have a denial in June and then another chance at the CSAB and then another vote from the State Board. They'd rather have that, obviously, than just an outright denial with no second chance from the State Board. I think one of the keys here is you have a number of applications that will come forward with either a unanimous or a very high threshold of votes in the affirmative that we're recommending to move forward. We want to move those folks, those high flyers, as quickly as mm-hmm. possible. We want to reward them for putting together an outstanding application, an outstanding board. We want to expedite that process as quickly as we can.
That's Alex Quigley, chairman of the North Carolina Charter School Advisory Board. He's speaking to the State Board of Education about tweaking the charter school approval process. State Board Chairman Bill Coby mentioned a hypothetical case.
It's probably split votes. The majority of the Charter School Advisory Board recommends, and then we decide, no, even though you recommend, we're going to vote to deny it, and this has actually happened. Is this more about when it goes back being able to address the questions that were raised?
Absolutely. I mean, it would give the board, one thing that I've been pressing the board members on this year is that if I sense that it's going to be a split vote or going to be a close vote, I'm asking board members to state for the record in the minutes the reason they're making their decision. So it's exquisitely clear to all of you where the board members fell on the decision and why they're voting the way they're voting, so that you have that information before you. Also, it does. It gives us an opportunity if there are questions, you know, one of the questions last year was, like, I don't understand why this was not sent forward or this one was and the other one wasn't. And so that if you did deny it, it would give us an opportunity to have a conversation, clarify that. Also, we had a vote that was a even tie. Because we had some board members absent. Yeah. And so we would be able to rectify that situation as well. So I think this just, it kind of builds an extra step in the process in the situation where things are not just exceedingly clear, which I think is good. It also will help us prevent a protracted argument with an applicant or a protracted where they feel like they weren't given, you know, a fair shake, even though I feel very, very confident that the decisions we make are fair, clear, equitable, and we've done tons of due diligence. I know as an applicant, I would appreciate, you know, the additional opportunity for the CSAB to review again.
Becky Taylor wonders whether charter schools need even more time.
I like that they're not waiting so long. It'd be nice if, I know it's hard to move it back forward, but they're having a hard, a lot of schools are having a hard time getting ready to open after, you know, after just 1 year.
Yes.
And I mean, it's, I don't know how you could back it up so they could have their approval perhaps like in March.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, so they'd have a much longer time, so we would not be having delays.
Quigley agrees, citing some charter schools' problems securing a location.
The facilities is a real issue. We have discussed ways that we could potentially do that. And what, you know, one way is having a rolling process. What you don't want to have happen is where you overly favor the schools that have the early interviews. So, you know, they have this huge advantage over schools that just get scheduled late in the calendar. I suggested just whoever puts in their application first gets their interview first. Mm-hmm. It's kind of rewarding the people that are beat the deadline. But I think that's something that I can take back to the board and say, hey, we have some support from the state board to consider adjusting the process somehow. We could potentially move up the application deadline
that's
and start earlier.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent discussion about the charter school application process. Potential changes would be designed to help new schools have more planning time. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It's called Carolina Cares. It's a bill supported by a bipartisan group of state legislators who want to expand Medicaid in North Carolina. Now, that is something that former Governor Pat McCrory and the Republican majority in the General Assembly have chosen not to do. We should stick with that decision, says Catherine Restrepo. She is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. She's joining us now to explain this new push by some to embrace a key provision of Obamacare. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you.
Interesting on a number of fronts, but let's start with this. It is a key provision of Obamacare, Medicaid mm-hmm. expansion, except
yes.
Obamacare seems to be really on slippery footing right now. So mm-hmm. why would a proposal like this come up at this point in time?
Yeah, well, I think at the federal level, there's a lot of uncertainty going on. You know, as you know, the federal Republicans in the House and Congress weren't able to get the American Health Care Act, their proposed Obamacare reform, health care reform, which is more of a market-based reform, passed for a full House vote before going on through the Senate. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and within that bill, there is going to be lots of changes with the way Medicaid, which is a health insurance program for low-income children, parents, elderly, blind, and disabled populations. And there's going to be a big shift in how that program was going to be funded. And so I think that with Obamacare's Medicaid expansion, if North Carolina were to expand, we would get so much of it would be paid for with federal funds. And if that is going to go away, I think this is pressuring states to expand before there's a deadline on that.
Explain to us what this group of legislators has proposed. They're calling it Carolina Cares, but what are the uh-huh. key elements of what they want to do?
Yeah, the key elements, it's I mean, it's very much representatives that have sponsored this bill will say this is not your typical Medicaid expansion. This is a unique version of expanding coverage for more low-income individuals. And what this bill does is that it expands coverage, but there's certain twists and certain flavors to it that is beyond your traditional Medicaid expansion. So there would be a work requirement. There would also, I mean, you would have to, if you signed on, if a patient decided to sign up, you would have to go to annual, you would have to get annual comprehensive physicals done. You would have to engage in preventative and wellness behaviors through different wellness programs. So there's also a lot of individual mandates. If you want to say that, that will be included in this bill. So there's some characteristics that are different, but overall, other states have passed similar bills just like this, and the actual enforcement of those things has really not been heavy.
How many people are we talking about here that would be added on to North Carolina's Medicaid rolls?
Yeah, about 500,000 would be added to the rolls. Right now, if you look at the program, it currently serves about 2 million people in our state, and it costs total state and federal funds combined about $14 billion. So it's one of the fastest growing line items in our state budget. And with expansion, yes, it would include those people who are currently in the coverage gap, meaning that they don't qualify for Medicaid and they don't bring enough income to qualify for a subsidized private health plan if they don't get health insurance through their job and they're working. But it also would shift a lot of people who are currently receiving subsidies with private plans on the exchanges onto Medicaid. And Medicaid is a program that has a far inferior track record than most other types of health insurance.
Now, let me make sure I understand, because that seems pretty important. Are you saying that of these 500,000 people that would be added under this proposal, that some of them currently have insurance?
Yes. Yes. A lot.
Well,
we're talking about one-third of the exchange population. And again, the exchange is if you don't have health insurance through your employer, you get it on your own. And depending on your income, you can qualify for a subsidy to purchase a health insurance plan. So, yes, it would be shifting about one-third of the exchange population onto Medicaid.
Catherine, you also mentioned that the idea behind Medicaid was really to be a social safety net for those folks who are very, very vulnerable, can't take care of themselves. And as a compassionate civil society, we would make sure that they were cared for. But as this program expands, what happens to those folks who really are qualified for this program and they're trying to get access to health care? And
yeah, and I'm so glad you bring up that point, because that's really the critical point of all of this. So we go back to access and to health care costs. When you have more people on a program, on this pool, and there's less of a supply, primary care providers, primary care physicians that can take care of these people. I mean, the traditional Medicaid population, the low-income children, elderly, blind, and disabled people, they're going to be competing harder for access, adequate access to healthcare, and fewer doctors are accepting new Medicaid patients.
Why is that?
Simply because Medicaid pays well below market rates, well below what commercial insurance companies reimburse their providers they contract with, and well below Medicare.
Would state taxpayers be on the hook if this expansion went forward?
Yes, and there's some creative financing that's going on with this particular bill, Carolina Cares. It's because, so right now, if we expand, starting in 2020, if we were to expand before then, but starting in 2020, the state would pick up 10% of the tab of the expansion population, so of these 500,000 people, and the federal government will pick up the rest, so the remaining 90%. And how the state portion would be financed is through these premiums that patients will supposedly be paying, hospital taxes, and that's the creative financing scheme we're talking about here. So essentially what happens is that hospitals agree to be taxed by the state. The state then gives that money back to the hospitals, and then when they give that money back to the hospitals, that triggers more federal funds, because that's just the way Medicaid financing works.
Okay, you're making my hair hurt just talking about how the whole thing works, and you've actually described it as a scheme,
yes.
And I understand why. So it's so complicated. So Catherine, it seems like there must be a better way to simplify this process and help people, more people, get access to health care mm-hmm. and be able to perhaps even buy an insurance policy that meets their individual needs versus all these mandates you were talking about.
Right, yes. And so instead of lawmakers, yes, this is a short-term coverage solution, but at the end of the day, we should be looking at health care. How can we make access better? Because right now, it's going to be worse for more people on this program who are competing for access. It's already difficult enough as it is. But how can we make health care more affordable? And there's a lot of things that have to be done at the federal level for that to really happen, really become widespread. But there's a lot of things that state lawmakers can do, too, and that's just to increase the supply of health care. I mean, get rid of certificate of need laws where that basically stifles innovation and stifles, you know, the ability for more providers to open up more facilities that offers lower cost alternatives for health care in rural areas especially. You know, let free up scope of practice laws where mid-level providers can relocate or practice on their own in many rural areas of North Carolina that are currently facing severe primary care shortages. So those are just a few ways in which you can open up the market, and you don't need necessarily so much subsidies to provide coverage for people.
Well, it is an ongoing discussion and debate at the federal level and right here in North Carolina. How do we make sure folks have access to care and also address the issue of insurance? Catherine mm-hmm. Restrepo is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. You can read all of her analysis on this, and she's written quite a bit about this at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.